Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to episode 353 with my guest, Andy Kindler. This was recorded live at LA Podfest a couple of weeks ago. But first, I want to tell you about Heaven's Gate, which is a new podcast from our former guest, Glenn Washington. Glenn's also the host of Snap Judgment, an amazing storyteller. And Glenn grew up in a cult. And this podcast, which is called Heaven's Gate, is about, I don't know if you remember from the news years ago, but there was a cult called Heaven's Gate. They were in San Diego, and they thought that a UFO was going to come down from heaven and save them. And Glenn talks to people who lost loved ones in that, people who still believe in the cult's teachings, etc., etc. But as you know, he's an incredible storyteller. So hear it for yourself. Subscribe to Heaven's Gate, the podcast, wherever you listen, like Stitcher or Apple Podcasts. My name is Paul Gilmartin, and this is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas, and sexual dysfunction to everyday compulsive negative thinking. Now, this show's not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I'm not a therapist. It's not a doctor's office. It's more like a waiting room that doesn't suck. The website for this show, as well as my Twitter and Instagram handle, is MentalPod. MentalPod.com, obviously, would be the website for that. I want to read a couple of surveys. I've gotten back into reading the Struggle in a Sentence survey. For those of you that are new to the podcast, there's about a dozen surveys you can go to our website and fill out anonymously. And they're a big part of the show. You know, half of the show is the interview with a guest, and then the other portion of the show is reading these anonymous surveys that you guys fill out. And these are from the Struggle in a Sentence, where people try to describe their struggle in a kind of concise way. This person calls himself, before I had good boundaries, I just built walls. And they write about their ADD. My favorite time to remember to take a long shower is when I'm cooking something at a high temperature. About their anxiety, I'm so exhausted from worrying about accomplishing nothing all day that I can't get out of bed until 2 o'clock. By the way, that's the time I got up today. About their alcoholism. I'm not an alcoholic. I just like to nap on the toilet in bars. About their love addiction. I love how much you're ambivalent towards me. And about their codependency, which apparently she said this to her addict boyfriend. Why are you doing this to me? Thank you for those. This was filled out by Nicole D. And she writes about her depression, like, I am a ghost floating through life, but unable to connect with anyone. about her anxiety, like my chest is being quickly filled with a dense gas and I need to evacuate the room ASAP before I explode. About her bulimia, like I've become possessed and am now only a bystander to the actions performed by my own body. Boy, I think anybody who struggles with compulsive behavior, just their bell just got rung by that one, man. About her anorexia, like having an evil twin whose entire life purpose is to follow you around day after day and tell you how disgusting you are. Thank you for those. This is filled out by Fuck Fuckery Fuck Fuck. I highly encourage you to go get your name legally changed to that and film it. About her love addiction, envying those who actually have someone to be addicted to, and about experiencing racial or cultural bias, not knowing if I should be offended when the teacher doesn't believe that I am actually black because apparently I don't have, quote, black people features or talk black. Wow. Wow. Yeah, I would say if that's... well, first of all, why anybody would question why whatever ethnicity is that you told them that you are is fucked up. But whether you didn't state whether that person said it overtly or not, so I'm a little confused. But so I'm not sure if that's what you're thinking in your mind, but I think it's fucked up whether they said something or not. I have been struggling lately, as I've shared with some of you, with learning to set boundaries and learning to respect people's boundaries and sense people's boundaries. And I told you that BetterHelp.com is one of the sponsors of this show, and I work with a therapist there, and she's great. I've been with her for about a year, and she said something to me at our last session. We do video-to-video sessions once a week, and she said, I want you to think about the difference between sharing something with somebody so that you can be validated because you're feeling an emptiness inside you versus sharing something with somebody because it's a part of a process of you getting to know each other. And that kind of really helped me understand it more, because one of the things that I struggle with is I have such a deep fear that I am inherently bad or unlovable or broken, or I should say a recurring feeling. You know, there are many moments when I feel like I'm okay and I'm loved and, you know, I'm on the path I'm supposed to be on, but there are times when I just go into a shame spiral. And one of the things that I do sometimes is I overshare because I want to be validated by somebody. I want to be told that I'm okay. And I feel like if I share, I'm imagining this is probably my thought process subconsciously, is if you know everything about me, then you have all the facts. So if you still like me or even love me, then maybe there's a chance that I am lovable. And that's not really fair to the other person because I'm making it all about me. They're almost just becoming a vessel for my validation. And it's a form of objectifying somebody. Whereas slowly getting to know each other, it's not about hitting, you know, that there's no end zone of validation. It's just you're enjoying the process of bit by bit, you know, listening to each other. There's no sense of urgency to it. And that really helped me. So I highly recommend BetterHelp.com. It's helped me. I love Donna, my therapist, and you can go to BetterHelp.com/mental, complete a questionnaire, and they'll match you up with a BetterHelp.com counselor, and you can experience a free week of counseling to see if online counseling is a good fit for you. You got to be over 18, but I love it. I love it. Before we get to the interview with Andy, I just have a couple more surveys. And This one is a struggle in a sentence survey filled out by Sam. And she struggles with depression. And she writes, every morning while I'm laying in bed, paralyzed by my own fucking mind, I have to listen to the cheery sound from a primary school playground across the street. That is like one of the weirdest things in life, is that when two completely different things are happening in the same space, like getting horrible news on a sunny day. Like, that's one of the things that just added to the fucked upness of 9/11, was that it was such a beautiful day. This one is filled out by just another sad fucker, and about their depression and anxiety. They write, depression and anxiety feels like being frozen in a block of ice inside your burning house. It keeps you frozen and helpless, but it's also the only thing keeping you safe from the flames. The feeling of always knowing it won't keep you safe from the inevitable pain that's fast approaching. That was a good one. Thank you for that. And then finally, this is an awfulsome moment filled out by, if you don't know Tunnock's tea cakes, you haven't lived. I have to say, that's the first time we've had that one as somebody's pseudonym. And this is their awfulsome moment. Today, my grandparents came around for lunch. A news item about the Harvey Weinstein sexual assault scandal prompted a discussion around the issues of sexual assault and rape. I won't bore you with the details, but both my grandfathers offered such gems as, the woman always starts it, and if they were really upset about it, they would have reported it sooner. My grandmother was notably quiet. Sensing rising tensions, my mom suggested that me, my dad, and my brother come and help her with the washing up. I was standing in the doorway that divides our dining room from our kitchen when I heard them muttering something like, I think we won that one, didn't we? I lost it. I started screaming that they needed to leave, and I was punching the fridge. I then proceeded to collapse on the floor and have a panic attack. My panic attacks are often mistaken for epilepsy. I lose complete control of my body, shake uncontrollably, arch my back, and scream continuously. I happen to have a very anxious, fluffy cockapoo named Archie. Whenever one of us is upset, he licks our faces until we reassure him we are okay, and this time was no exception. He ran into the kitchen and started frantically licking my face. Unfortunately, because I had no control over my body, I was unable to shut my mouth or stop screaming. And this is how I ended up choking on my dog's tongue as he licked my tonsils. Eventually, my mom noticed and formed a protective barrier around my mouth with her hands. Once I finally stopped screaming and shaking and my breathing returned to normal, I looked up at my mom, the grandparents now long gone, and my head was in her lap. All she said was, I think we need to talk to Archie about consent.
I'm so scared of being alive and so scared of dying.
I was so, so lonely, but I couldn't bear being around people, and it hurt.
I've just been, like, very interested in dicks.
I don't know how to let loose and just be.
All my alters have different handwriting and different...
Extremely anxious.
Affects.
I am most turned on when I am in fear.
My first thought was I'm about to die.
Stomach clutching despair.
Ocean of sadness.
I came out over the phone to them.
I put myself on the Atkins diet in fourth grade.
They told me I was wrong.
The secrecy is what kills us.
And I just sat there and cried on his shoulder.
And it was the first time I ever felt safe, like a weight lifted off of me.
In order to get rid of your anger, you have to learn how to cry.
I started liking myself for the first time.
I'm afraid that people are only nice to me because they're afraid I'll kill myself if they're not.
Oh, that's fantastic. That is fantastic.
For coming to the Mental Illness Happy Hour, please welcome your host, Paul Gilmartin.
Hello, hello. Thank you, guys. Thank you so much for coming. Thanks to LA Podfest for existing and inviting me to be a part of it. I so look forward to this every year. I really hope that they do it again next year. There's some talk that they don't know financially if they'll be able to afford to do it next year. But I hope this isn't the last one at the podcast. Why do I got to bring it down right out of the gate? Why do I feel like I got to go to the sad place with you guys? Like something upbeat would just be. What is this positivity? This lightness? It burns. I'm so excited to have Andy on. He and I met probably 20 years ago. I was writing marketing copy for the WB Network back before it merged and became the CW. And they would hire a bunch of comedians to come in, and it was kind of almost a rotating door. And I was aware of Andy's comedy before that and was a fan, but when I got to work with him every day, I looked forward to work because he just made it so fun, and he made me laugh, and to this day makes me laugh so hard, and I'm so glad he can be here. Please welcome my friend Andy Kindler.
Thank you, man. Regular Jim Carney, am I right? With the physical
Jim
humor?
Carney.
Jim Carrey, it's my Jim Carrey joke.
Okay.
Like, I don't remember his name.
For the listeners, Andy just sashayed in.
Sashayed in. Hilarious. Everything. Exactly. But when I first did stand up spots, I didn't have the speech impediment. I would plan my ad libs. It's not a good thing.
So many things to talk about. To avoid emotionally. This is, I don't know if you'll be able to dodge for an hour. Will you be able to deflect with humor?
Well,
for
I've
a
been
solid
running
hour?
Away from my feelings for so long
yeah.
that I'm expert
yeah.
at avoiding it. I use humor a lot.
Yeah.
Just, you know, you ask me
some
something
would,
real.
Some would disagree.
Well, I didn't say I use it well. That's because I use it as a deflection. Yeah. It's not real comedy.
When I heard you on Marc Maron, I was really shocked because you talked about having OCD and you got really open and you didn't deflect with humor. And I was like, oh my God.
That was humor, Paul. That was one of my bits about OCD.
Oh, it didn't go well then.
Oh, not funny. I forgot.
Yeah, you need to tighten that up.
I knew listing the side effects was a bad idea.
Yeah, it's not very compelling.
No, you're right. That happened. Yeah. And how long ago? That was like right when I got into. I've been advertising myself as the oldest Jew to enter therapy. I was 59 years old when I entered therapy.
Were you?
I'm not really. My wife says. Please, do you have to tell the wait person how old you are? Just give it a rest. Why don't you go down on Hollywood Boulevard and tell people, I'm dying. I'm dying inside. I mean, don't get me wrong. This is the time period that, you know, I have this joke. I say, they came knocking on my door because they were afraid I might have died. I don't know. I'm not saying the joke right. But the point is... I said, at this age, Hollywood's knocking down my door because they're
afraid. To see if you're okay.
And see if I'm alive.
Yeah.
Or checking the various assisted livings.
Have you picked out an assisted living yet?
No, but you know what I do?
I'm
going to be all over it.
Yeah, you want to get a jump on traffic.
You know what I spend? I'm not lying either. I spend half my time with mail avoiding AARP tricks. They try it.
Yeah?
Yeah. They go, your cards are here. They know if you see the name, you're going to throw it against a wall, right?
Right.
But they go, your cards are inside.
Yeah.
They refuse to put their name on the outside. That's, and now, but now is my chance. I'm sorry. I do have OCD. And in fact, I did OCD all the way up to this coming out. As you were saying my name,
what were you
I was doing?
Doing
a classic OCD thing. My addiction is Twitter, other things too. I don't know why I feel this would show it.
He's waving his phone around.
Here's where the transgressions occur. And one of the things you do on Twitter is it's called checking. It's an obsessive compulsive thing. So I tweet something.
How many times a day do you, because some might label that as narcissism.
Oh, I think it definitely, I think we have.
And that's not meant as a shot, it's just.
No, we're all in the continuum, right? So I'm probably at the Ricky Gervais level of narcissism. The thing you want to avoid is you want to avoid the Trump level of narcissism. I know you don't talk about politics, and as soon as you said don't talk about politics, you didn't really say that.
Yes.
But as soon as you said that, I said, you know what? It's about to get political in here.
Well, anybody that would...
You know what? I don't enjoy the president.
Andy. The listener is missing so much with Andy's facial expressions. I really wish we were live streaming. He's mugging up a storm right now.
Muggler.
Yeah,
Muggler.
I think anybody who would send me an email that says Trump is not a narcissist would enjoy my trash bin. So let's talk about Twitter first.
Okay.
Because you can be really combative on Twitter. You're very outspoken.
That's a nice way to put it, combative.
You upset some people on Twitter. You've always been very honest about things that you view as bad or mediocre in entertainment, and you call them out, and usually in a way that is so funny, but I would imagine painful sometimes for the person on the receiving end, give me some examples of my favorite joke that have gotten bad reactions. Like my favorite joke that you do, it was not at a person's expense, but I still quote it to this day. Did you guys ever see the there was a Comedy Central show called Tompkins Square, and it was stand up that was done outside in Tompkins Square in New York, and Andy's joke was just what comedy needs, more depth of field.
I even laughed at my own material. Depth of field.
That is just
adding the missing ingredient.
Such classic Andy Kindler. But let's talk.
I'll give you a couple examples, right? Yeah, okay. Yes. Who died made Jim Belushi a big star? Jay Leno has a car that runs on the energy of all the people's dreams that he's crushed. Bill Maher is like Hitler, except Hitler was likable. Donald Trump is like Hitler, except at least Hitler was a veteran. But actually, the stuff that's happened online with Twitter, I wish it was this is the big danger, and it's not big danger. I'm not. There's two sides of my problem: thinking that everything's going to be the end of the world, thinking that any negative behavior I exhibit means I'm the behavior. Mm-hmm. But you know, like, so I spend so much of my life defending against outbursts or defending against people not liking what I was doing by trying to justify it, because I realized that I couldn't accept myself as someone who wouldn't be perfect. So that's so there's two sides.
So you're trying to control the ripples of what you do.
Yeah, and the controlling is like, if I get mad online and I'm trying to control, I'm trying to both make the person like me by saying negative things about them, or, but it's all about me fighting for my reputation. Like, one of the first things I learned in therapy was, one of my big problems on Twitter is, like, I heard something on Radiolab, and it's a good podcast, but they had announced that the nephew, Brendan Dassey, anybody know these names? Brendan Dassey. He had been...
Making a murderer?
Yeah, but the Brendan Dassey, I mean, I think, is he out of jail? Anyone know?
Still in there.
But it became clear that he had been manipulated into giving a confession. Yeah. So Radiolab was playing an old episode of Radiolab where they were saying he was guilty. This was before they found out the confession was manipulated.
And they didn't bother to edit
so
it
out. So I'm like yelling in my car, how is anyone going to know this is from the past? Well, I tweeted them like six times. And so my therapist said, well, what do you expect to happen? I say, I do want it to change. And it's not going to, you can't change people by bugging them that much.
So where do you think the need to control? I mean, everybody obviously is looking for some type of control in our
right.
lives. But when it becomes unmanageable and begins to have negative side effects, do you become aware that I should just let something go? I'm not the policeman of comedy or entertainment. I should just let it be because I'm going to get caught in another tornado of.
Well, let me put it. The thing about it is that there's two problems. One problem is that since I've started both therapy and also Prozac, I literally forget, and I have ADD and OCD, and they go together.
Did you get a discount on the second?
Yes. get the Prozac and get an Adderall half price. Today, did I say the wrong word? Oh, I'm the bad guy because I'm on because I do endorsement commercials for Adderall. I forget what I'm saying in the moment. So you had just asked me a question. I completely forgot the question. Yeah. And that's been one of my problems that I have to admit.
You think of a joke, you get sidetracked, and then you can't remember where you came from.
Well, this was worse. This was thinking of an actual, just a feeling. It wasn't like, I hope this goes over. I couldn't remember. You said something about, do you remember what you asked?
About being controlling.
You don't have ADD.
Do you find... I do take Adderall, and that actually helps with my depression.
I could see that. I take Adderall, too.
Yeah, it was...
It also helps me with his depression. Too soon?
How conscious are you as you begin to publicly... get into a Twitter war with somebody, or are you aware at all that sometimes you're making it worse by not letting something go?
There's no question about it, but so much of the time, like I have my own podcast now, it's called Thought Spiral. Don't listen to, I'm not trying to take over. Thank you. It had to be said.
What, I didn't even know you had it. I'm the worst researcher ever. What did you say?
Thought_spiral, because we didn't have the money to get the...
Yeah.
Someone beat us to it. Yeah, it's Josh Elvis Weinstein, who is a very funny guy. He used to be on Mystery Science Theater, and he wrote for Freaks and Geeks. He's hilarious. And we just talk. No guests. We just talk. And it's very hard.
Yeah.
And so why did I say that? Okay. So one of the things I realized was that a problem with OCD people and ADD people is I also overshare, I overshare.
Yeah, I struggle
thinking
with that
I'm too. Being honest.
Yes.
And it's not, it's like not everybody needs to know that I'm on, I have ADD and OCD and I just started therapy and I'm the oldest Jew to get into it. But everybody does know.
Yeah.
And so I'd like to change that a bit.
Do you see the sometimes feeling like I have to take this person down on Twitter or let them know that I think their movie is horrible or they're a bad actor? Do you feel... Where do you feel that comes from? Do you feel that comes from a disorder you have? And is that making an excuse for behavior that some would say, that's...
Well, yeah, let's say that you can't just justify it by saying it's me. Well, since I've discovered what my problem was, which I didn't know my whole life, I had OCD in my early 20s, and then it kind of like faded. And so... since I didn't know what was going on, I forgot now. Just lead me a little bit back towards it. I'm not high, folks.
Yeah. Did you, when you get into a beef with somebody?
Oh, okay, right. Yes. So here's the thing. My life is based on, almost everything in my life is based on fears of when I was a kid. So I was 5 feet 4'11" through high school. You know, I shot up to 5'5½" to Senko de Mayo, as Boris Hamilton says. But I was, I've always been deathly afraid of being beaten up. And when I was in middle school, or we used to call it junior high school, I actually, no, it was fifth grade. This guy, every day for like a week, said he was going to beat me up in front of other people, and I would freak out because I knew my name. This was my joke that I came up with, where the guy goes, "You want me to meet me at 3 o'clock?" And I'm like, "I'm not going to make an appointment to get my ass kicked." You know? "Oh, I'm getting verbally abused at 2:45. Can we push it back?" So that was one of my, that was always one of my big fears. But the other side of that, so I am extremely careful. I would never have done the Kathy Griffin error of, "Gee, I wonder if decapitating the president, you know, president fictionally."
Right.
It'll be a problem. So I'm very, I know what, I don't ever say anything, even though I want to, because I'm from New York.
So you do hold back on
I
things.
I do hold back, because in New York, people will kick the shit out of you. I can't kick the shit out of anybody. Even though I've taken Taekwondo, I'm scared of fighting. I don't want to fight. So I know, I'm not trying to whip it up, but I am angry in that moment. So in that moment, I guess I'm trying to say something.
So it sounds like a battle between a desire to be heard and a fear of confrontation.
Right, so that's the thing. Since I discovered this problem, I've actually had a better relationship towards like my quote act. Because I used to, in my act, I would get into these things like, "I need to take Jay Leno down. The very existence of the universe depends upon me telling people that Jimmy Fallon is superficial. It is my job,"
right,
as a guy wrote an article about me, called me an ombudsman, the ombudsman of comedy. And now I'm feeling guilty because he was a New York Times writer. I can't remember his name. Boom! That was just a 5-second obsession compulsive explosion.
What happened? What happened just there?
I started to worry about his name. Then I started to think about his name. And then I thought, he just wrote a book about Letterman. I should remember his name. These are all thoughts I had in the last 5 seconds.
Wow.
So just to cover up. So I used to think I had to justify my act, and my act had to be, I'm for the good and I'm beating the bad. But my comedy, humor has always been in my family forever, and it is kind of like the most spiritual thing I can do. I really believe that. So because I wasn't willing to look at my own behavior, like in my marriage or anywhere, because it would be a tragedy if I admitted that I exhibited these whatever unpleasant things are, you know? Like, I got once on a podcast, I got an argument with this guy, Josh Zepps, and it was like a, like, I was really upset, and I got really upset, and then my wife was, she got upset, but I was like, "What are you getting?" You know, so I was kind of like, "What?" And I went to therapy, and it's like, and so my therapist said, "What?" I said, "Well, I may have been acted wrong, or acted just," he goes, "Is that the worst thing in the world, really?" Well, for me, it is the worst thing in the world, but because I was so upset, I didn't want my wife to be upset with me. She didn't even know what was going on. All she could hear was half of this argument and me raising my voice. I'm already thinking she's judged me. So, like, it's all these things get in the way of me actually looking at my behavior. So most of the things that people observe about me on Twitter are in the past. That's the problem with it. It's not, oh, I'm happy. My friends, every one of my friends, close friends, has talked to me about Jimmy Pardo. Well, he's not that close with him. But let's not begin. No, Jimmy Pardo was like, what's wrong with you? And a lot of people. And I thank people. I mean, I do thank people for doing that, because these are people who, like, they know who I am and they know what I believe, maybe, but they're just saying, this is the way it looks from the outside. Like,
right. It looks like, some people probably think, oh, he's doing it for attention. You know, he's using other people to, you know, because you think of a great joke that would be at somebody's expense doesn't mean you should do it.
I think my problems generally aren't the jokes, because now that I think about all the speeches I've done in Montreal and all that stuff, it's very rarely that it gets into where I'm making fun of Louis C.K., who I, you know, I say Louis C.K., his fashion sense is American Gervais. So, but my anger, I have anger at Louis C.K. from personal things that we went through. So the more I'm able to admit that there's something going on that isn't just, I'm not here to save the world. It almost never...
I see. I think it's a personal decision for every person of where, if they're, you know, tweeting or whatever, what am I going to interject myself into? How much am I going to talk about a specific person as opposed to an issue? So you talked about it coming from a place of anger with Louis. Can you be more specific? I don't expect you to divulge specific things about your relationship.
Well, I don't even mind because
him.
It's so mundane. It's not like he punched me in the face after we slept together. I don't know what I'm saying. No, he... there was something that happened at a club many years ago, and I really loved Louis, and I wanted him to like me and all this kind of thing. And then it was something happened at the club where they had double booked us at this club, and so I was complaining to him about it, and he was like being a little standoffish about it. So my whole thing was, all he cares about is he's not worried about my career, he's just worried about his career. So that's what it was. And the reason why I say that's what it was is because part of comedy is anger, right?
Yeah.
Because if I really don't like someone, it's fun to come up with many ways that I don't like them, humorously.
Yeah. I heard somebody say one time that stand-up comedy is socially acceptable hostility.
Yeah. I think that's true.
Yeah.
So I wanted to, there were things that bothered me, like about Louis. What was bothering me wasn't even so much Louis, was just like everyone was saying, he's the greatest stand-up comic in the history of the world. Well, he's not the greatest. There are 20 or 30 comics who are at least as funny as Louis C.K. And when I say that, I mean I think they're funnier. But if I didn't have the core feeling of not feeling good about our relationship, I probably would never have said that joke.
I gotcha. And what do you think was underneath that anger at him? Because, there's that moment about the double booking, but obviously there's a feeling underneath it because it's usually more than about the double booking or somebody taking your parking space.
I think, without sounding like, it's easy when you're, not in the middle of an argument to sound like you're a saint, but I think it's about maturing. See, I used to be like, if I find something, because I didn't, a lot of it has to do with I didn't know what my parents were going to do, so I had to kind of guess what they were going to do. So I got into that thing of trying to figure out what they wanted me to do to avoid the behavior, right?
What was the fear that your parents would do?
Nothing. They weren't there. Mom, don't listen to this. Janet and Robert, if you listen to this, tell Mom, ixnay. Well, she can't operate a device. My mother was not there, kind of, because she was like, she had her own issues that she was dealing with, but I didn't know because I was a kid. And kids, if you don't know, you don't know.
You assume it's you.
Nobody 4 years old says, look, she's going through something. It's nothing. No, this is not a reflection about me.
Yeah.
There's no reason for me to take this personally. My therapist says you take everything personally when you're that age. Although every time I recount a story, I'm always five. So something's wrong with me. Like, I don't understand the difference between 5 and 12 properly.
It's interesting. The 5 keeps coming up because you were 5 feet 5. And 5 then feet that, 5. That something happened at 5, and then there was another 5
My
in there.
My career was over in 95.
Talk more about what you remember from childhood, what you remember thinking or feeling, your place in the world, and what you thought the future held.
Well, one thing for sure that I had concluded was that because my parents were unpredictable, so I had to figure out what everybody was thinking before they were thinking it or as they were thinking it, and then I could make my decision on how to deal, which usually meant running up to my room or avoiding the rest of the family. But the thing that I did that was bad about that was I'm almost always wrong now. When, especially with my wife, it's like she'll start to say something. If for some reason, I'm jumping in, giving the last part of what am I trying to prove? That I know who the Secretary of the Interior is? And then she's, I'm not talking about the Secretary of the Interior. Well, in case you were, don't think I didn't know that name. So I'm always wrong. I'm almost always wrong.
So your brain, you're putting a lot of mental energy into your crystal ball, which is based in fears. And so then your actions come as a result of all this new information coming in and being filtered through your version of what you think the future is going to be based on how these people are going to react.
And also a system that was worked and necessary for me when I was four. Because I
can you be specific about how it worked and how your parents would be unpredictable.
They would be okay. So like if my parents say, hey, if you break something, my parents were antique collectors. Mm-hmm. All right, you do the math. No, so I was like, if you break something, we don't care.
Right.
Like, you just, as long as you tell us. Why did you break? Well, you said it doesn't matter. Yes, but if you had been thinking, you wouldn't have bumbled. So it's like, there were no rules. What my life didn't have was discipline. Like, my parents were not disciplined. They were like, we didn't know when dinner was going to be. It was always going to be early. But why are they calling at dinner was something we
so
often
So there was
heard.
Not much structure in your life.
Well, there was structure that we structured ourselves, kind of. All the kids were good at, I made my own food, I did all this type of thing. But there was the thing, I used to think I hated routines and things. But my sister says, as a teacher and like a principal, that kids want structure.
Yeah.
I didn't have any of that.
Yeah. <He's>, Andy was
fake
crying.
Yeah. Which you would also, this could be an observation you could make after watching any of my acting.
What would you be best known for? Everybody Loves Raymond.
That's the problem. I thought, well, there's two things I like to say that I'm known for. No. Raymond, I was a recurring character. How many episodes? 29 episodes from 1996 to 2004. And then the other thing is, which I'm most proud of in a way, is I did recurring pieces for Letterman years.
It. Yeah.
And that's my favorite thing I did.
Yeah.
But I loved Raymond, too. Yeah. I'm available for more sitcom work. A lot of these people here are going, he can't probably take the work. He's so busy.
So let's go back to the the unpredictability and the if you could go back in time and talk to yourself when you were five or whatever age, what would you say to that
I mean,
kid?
I would tell myself that it's not you. These people are. And I would try to soothe like a lot of things I find out from OCD is that you're trying to soothe yourself. Yeah. So you're trying to get, and when I was with my therapist one day and I said to her, why am I doing that? Why do I keep doing it? She goes, you have, unless this hurts for you to hear it, he goes, you have an illness. And while I don't think the illness metaphor works in every way with OCD, it gets me out of the, why did I do that? Why was I doing that? Like people with ADD have bad impulse control. They make bad decisions over and over and over again. You can only drive yourself so crazy with why. OCD goes back in my family forever. Mm-hmm. And so the thinking is that it's just a fight, flight, or freeze reaction that no longer applies to your life now. So when I remember that it is an illness, that there's an illness component to it, I can both look at the behavior and let myself off the hook, not meaning I'm never going to have to worry about adjusting my behavior, but just getting this whole thing of the world is black and white, you're a bad person, which I think was my core belief. And so anytime anything happens in life, I need to both look at my behavior and also realize it's not the end of the world. So I can't live if I think the stuff I did on Twitter yesterday defines me. But the truth is that it doesn't define me, you know? If it does define me, it's because I've let it define me. I mean, certainly, like that woman who tweeted that thing about going to Africa, I forget what she was, like a PR person, and she goes, well, I don't have to worry about AIDS because I'm white or something like that. By the time she landed in Africa, she'd lost her job. You know, I understand that things can happen to you
right. That
are and horrible things like that happened to Leslie Jones on Twitter, where you have these right-wing, all-right people and all this stuff. But to go on as a person, I cannot base it on trying to fix all the stuff
right.
I did yesterday,
yes.
Because that's what I've normally done.
And I think a lot of times people will misconstrue, is that a word?
It is somebody, if you're misconstruing something.
Yes. They will.
I'm up in your grill, baby.
They will misconstrue somebody's bad behavior with them not caring that they did something.
Exactly.
When in reality, it's you should be aware of it. You should try to learn from it. Look at what might have triggered me. So if that happens in another instance, I can react differently. But the important thing is, like you said, to not beat yourself up because you did that. To have some forgiveness and some gentleness with yourself, because it is an illness. But not to say I have an illness as a carte blanche. I don't have any responsibility for what I do. I think then the responsibility just becomes I need to put in a good effort to manage this behavior, to be aware of it and to see how I can get better at managing it.
Or like say it's between me and my wife. I, when I was really addicted to Twitter or really in ADD mode, she'd say something to me and I'd say, "What'd you say?" And then she'd say it again. Well, now after all these years, she's slightly annoyed by it,
Yeah.
So I can both realize it's not the end of the world that I'm doing it, but I can also realize that it affects because it's what I was trying to do was control people, because I felt that my happiness, my worth as a person was based on the perceptions of society or perceptions, and I forgot what I'm saying.
So your sense of safety in the world was how people viewed you.
Oh, right. So I would always try to adjust to see, either convince them that it went down a way that was, I wasn't doing what they said that I was doing, right. Or, but ultimately, because it's the false belief that the only way to get better is to control the other people, or the only way to survive is to control, and you literally cannot control the other people.
And it becomes the very thing you wanted to avoid.
Right.
The very thing. It's like, it's crazy how self-fulfilling trying to control other people will be. Whatever it is you fear will happen that you think you need to control them, that is what will happen when you try to control them.
Yeah, it's like realizing you're narcissistic.
Yeah.
I'm narcissistic.
What did you hear?
What's that?
You said you're narcissistic. What did you hear?
But that doesn't mean I'm Trump. You know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't mean it's good. And it doesn't mean that it's ultimately so bad that I should be killed for it. See, because I'm talking about things in therapy. I don't even remember these things, but like when I was like 4 years old, I didn't know where my parents were for like a second at Jones Beach, and all of a sudden I just went crazy in terms of fear of abandonment. Mm-hmm. So I think on some level I didn't feel confident about them taking care of me. And so that's what you're trying to deal with. That's what I'm trying to deal with in therapy is to... This is a really weird thing. It's like, what is the feeling you're having? Like, I have, like, if I'm heating up food, to eat, I go, all of a sudden I get depressed. I go, oh, it's like, and now I examine, are you really depressed about that? It's almost always something else going on.
Was it because you had to cook for yourself as a kid?
No, it was because it's something, I'm associating something with a smell or a color or an experience, and I am accepting it within myself to take me down a bit, it's like I just decide, of course heating up food is annoying. No, it's not annoying, It's like I've never been more successful, and not successful career-wise, but just getting down here, you said get down here by 3:15 to 3:30. I got here at 3:30. It's a miracle that I was here a half hour before a show, because I've made the focus of being on time not to kill myself, because that's one of my problems is being yelled at for being late, but trying to get out of all these different things that are happening to you, what's the main thing that you need to do, especially for OCD people and ADD people. Like, there's one book called, it's called Delivered from Distraction. Mm-hmm. It's really a great book. And he says, like, for example, I'm bad at filling out contracts with my manager. It takes me 4 or 5 days longer. You go, why? And I know that it's me agonizing. So, like in the book, they go, if you can delegate those things, that's great. So I asked Bruce, do you mind, you know, can you sign, which you used to do anyway? And now he says, but I imagine, but the old days, I wouldn't even ask
for
the thing.
You'd be ashamed? Or you wouldn't even realize that was an option?
No, because what I tended to do was get angry. Why is he not signing my paperwork for me? You know, he should be signing my paperwork for me because I'm afraid of asking for it because I don't think that's one of my biggest problems is confront actual confrontations of things that are bothering me. And I used to go from like, oh, you know, I'm a nice person, and then I would get like upset.
Yeah.
So I said to him, you know, can you do this? He said, no problem. So again, my assumption of how he would react was wrong. But regardless, even if he did, if he said, no, I'm not signing it, it wouldn't have mattered. The hell I've put myself, not hell, real hell, not like Holocaust hell, but I have relatives.
A warm room. Let's call it a warm room.
War room.
Yeah, a little stuffy.
A little stuffy.
Yeah.
The pain I put myself through on the assumptions, which has always been, I have to cajole or connive. Mm-hmm. I can't possibly be honest.
Anything that starts with C?
Except creative. How's my sweaty upper lip look? What am I worried about?
It's good.
I'm worried
it's
that
good.
You won't rebook me for another problem.
So have you, as you've begun to understand what has been happening to you all your life and what you've been using to soothe yourself, have you found a sense of freedom and optimism about
things? I have.
Can you talk about what, as you begin to develop these tools and insight on yourself, if you can think of any slices of life that you can share with us where
I really can. And in fact, I can express this from one of my biggest problems on Twitter, and I lost a lot of friendship. I'm not kidding. I lost about 20
friends. Oh, you don't have to convince
friends
me.
Friends with 20 comics.
I used to have a fear that you would turn on me and you would publicly humiliate me.
I'm not doing this to be funny. Maybe I couldn't have heard that 5 years ago.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I would have turned that into, why is Paul all over me for the things? But, you know, and because I...
Because you would have gone right to your fear of something happening instead of just really taking it in.
Right. Right. So,
Give me a slice of what it's
One of my biggest arguments online, and I'm not even saying this now to say I don't believe, I believe 100% what my point of view is on this, but I'm learning to express it in a way that, because I'm so scared, the fear is that these other, like my dad was kind of an atheist, but he was a nicer atheist than a lot of the new ones, but this fear... that he knows something more than me. He would argue with me. He didn't even know he was belittling me in the argument, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I love my dad. I mean, my dad passed away, and it's like my hero, but I'm dealing with all these things about, like... So a lot of these arguments is because I'm not confident enough in my own... not even called belief system. But I believe that if you hate someone based on their religion, just based on their religion, that's like the worst thing you can... It's like it goes against the basis of this country. It's like the First Amendment or whatever the amendment that covers it, it's freedom... we wanted the freedom to practice or observe any religion here, not a specific religion. That was the whole point of it. And my mother, who when I was 16, became a Quaker... She has told me amazing things about how the Quakers from Amsterdam wrote letters to us in the New World here about how religious freedom is more important than anything else. And in my lifetime, we've gotten to this thing where there's been these mean atheists, and then there's been this whole just Islamophobic movement. And so I would get into these horrible arguments online because... I still am angry about people hating people. Mm-hmm. Like Bill Maher, he doesn't know anything about Islam. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was like people have said to me that my mother being a Quaker is bad. It's bad. It's like it's objectively bad. And I know, because I've experienced it, that it is not bad. Mm-hmm. It's good. You know, and many...
She doesn't get tired of the oatmeal? How do I not do that?
Come on. That's
There's
the best,
no way.
That's the best spin I've heard on that one.
Yeah.
Because people ultimately mix up Shakers with Quakers. And you know, the thing is, Quakers were called Quakers because when they would be going into these like moments of silence, they would make sometimes shake. Mm-hmm. They liked it. They liked that part of it. So they weren't even embarrassed to be called
Quakers. Yeah.
But when you're talking, like good friends of mine, this is where it's misleading Twitter. Like it used to be, it's easy if it's a robot, I shouldn't be engaging. Why am I? But if it's a friend of mine I've had for many, many years who's now become an asshole atheist, mm-hmm. you know, and he was telling me that my mother is, you know, oh, she's not a bad person, but what she believes is bad. Well, she doesn't even believe anything. It's,
right.
It's just it's a group of people get together and be quiet.
Right.
That's all it is.
And so it's my audience.
Yeah.
But they don't get together. They stay in their bed.
Exactly.
But when you say asshole atheist, you don't mean this person's an asshole because they're an atheist. You mean in that they try to force their atheism on other people.
Well, there's a continuum to it. I mean, I really do think that the people, I mean, I've said it a million
times. Because judging somebody for being an atheist is, to me, is every bit as bad as judging somebody for believing a religion.
Yeah, but before
and
you
I believe
clap,
in God.
Before you clap, realize that I have nothing against atheism. In fact, I have a joke in my act that was like, to me, an atheist used to be just someone who looked depressed at a picnic. You know what I mean? Most of my friends are atheists. My father's an atheist. That's not the problem. It's the atheists who say you're an idiot for believing anything. Because these people, as Karen Armstrong, who's a great person to read on this, she says, like, these people wouldn't, the amount they know about religion could fit on the back of a postage stamp. They don't know about, these people don't know about my mother being a Quaker. That's what I was getting so angry at. Okay. You're looking up online, oh, I just found out that the Quakerism is based on Abrahamic religion and that some Quakers were owned slaves. Some Quakers owned slaves? Many people owned slaves, but the Quakers were famous for being against slavery,
right.
You know? So it's just... I'm not against... So the point is, I'm not against atheists, and I actually... I really believe that most people say, when they say they're atheists, they basically mean they're rejecting the formal training or the, you know, the Bible as being real, which I rejected when I was in third grade. So the spiritual part of me is that I think there's this whole side of life that you cannot just think through. And atheism is not science. There's no science based on atheism. And the atheism based on, you got to prove to me whatever it is that you believe, even if you're saying it's not a belief, that it exists, like a, you know, like a guy with a shirt on,
yeah.
that you can produce in this room before I have any interest. And I was like, these guys, like, even when they're like Tyson, is that his name?
Yeah.
Tyson or these guys, they sound like they've never dropped acid or never, you know, whatever we did, or I'm speaking for myself, those were spiritual experiences. When you're dancing to music and you're getting high, and of course you can have a problem with it later in life, but the point is, that's what I mean by spiritual.
Something,
and there's that side to the universe, and there's also another side. But you can't tell me the spiritual side doesn't exist. Because based on your theory of why people have a spiritual side.
Well, you're Andy's taking a bow now.
But no, I just really want to be honest that I have absolutely nothing against an atheist who isn't telling me I'm an asshole.
Yes.
Or other people are assholes.
How about people who are bored in church?
That's the
thing.
You
said it's a continuum, right?
Well,
would it be atheists, incredibly... would never consider going to church, bored in church, go to church out of guilt,
right.
Love church, shut the fuck up.
Yeah. This is the irony, if I knew what that word meant. I never thought, if you told me when I was a kid I would be defending organized religion, I would have thought you were crazy, because there's so many, I couldn't spend, you know, like, I used to say, how can Jews be self-hating? Mm-hmm. I say, spend a day at the temple where I grew up and make your own decision. You know, it's like, obviously... I'm culturally Jewish,
right.
But I don't. I'm not Simiat Seres. I don't have trouble going to sleep the night before Simiat Seres, like you would with Christmas, which is the greatest holiday ever.
Right. Let's get back
let's get physical.
To a slice, a moment of you beginning to feel the ability to navigate with this new knowledge and maybe some tools to soothe yourself in a way other than going into OCD or predicting the future.
Oh, like things I've come up with?
Yeah, or moments that you've experienced where you're like, wow, you know, 5 years ago I would have reacted this way, but now I reacted this way. I'm growing. I'm changing. Do you have any moments you can share with us?
I'll give you just one thing. It sounds mundane, but like I've always been into alternative comic books like Daniel Klaus and Harvey Pekar and all these great people, and they bring me so
Joe
much.
Sacco.
Joe Sacco is Great Palestine, right? Isn't that
his?
Yeah. This thing of like, I've got to the point in my life where I couldn't read that much anymore. Like, I really can't. It's like, it's part of the ADD thing. I can read when I read, and I can retain, but I don't have the desire. I'm not, never going to read these books I've claimed to have read already. So, it's like, but these graphic novels, I know that's the wrong word. No one likes the words that are used for it. Graphic memoirs, however you want to define pictures and words together, that it is endlessly brings me joy. But I have to remember to get offline, get off somewhere, and take one of those books and allow my. But I would, 5 years ago, I go, I gotta go, I gotta get successful. I gotta make sure I'm doing this, I'm making sure I'm doing that.
I see.
My therapist says, you and your wife should go out to the movies. You and your wife, it's like, it sounds like the most. Like, how aren't you already doing that? But you're not already doing that.
Yeah. Like, go to the movies. I got to get on getting in a movie.
That's exactly the entire thing. And also, I race around all the time, racing around, and I'm not saving any time. In other words, like, I want to clear out my closet. Oh, I can't clear my closet. The problem is the storage unit has to go. Well, the storage unit's not going to go until you allow yourself to sit in the closet for a couple of hours. And I know this is true because I'm an older man now, and I know that I have not reached any more success. I've not been successful at one bit more by hating myself, yelling at myself, rushing, watching cable news for 30 hours a day.
Yeah. Nothing will ensure depression like that. It's really hard to find a balance between not depressing yourself and not and shirking your duty as a citizen. At least these days, it's really hard because I get depressed after 30 seconds of reading or watching what's going on. But I don't want to be a bad citizen, and I don't know where that.
Well,
that line is, I just consider myself a bad person.
Yeah, see, I think that's not good either because, like, I really relate to the part of Buddhism where it's like not so much that you don't, it's not so much that you don't enjoy the highs or enjoy the lows, but that you kind of like have an equanimity towards everything that's coming at you.
Yeah.
So you don't get that depressed, you don't get that happy, or you know, I'm not saying you don't want to have the moments of euphoria, but you shouldn't. It's not helping the world for me to be watching MSNBC for 20 hours and screaming.
Yeah.
That's not helping either.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that going out to an actual event wouldn't help, but no, I'm just kidding.
Yes.
No, I mean, going out to an event. It's like when I marched against the Vietnam War. That little march I did when I was 13 years old, did that change the world? Well, it did for me because I remember it all the time. So it's like you don't think. You think that you have to be vigilant and you have to be checking out every disaster, but that's not good for us.
It is up to us to vote and to speak our minds, but not to try to control other people through humiliating them, degrading them, et cetera, et cetera.
That's true. Because there used to be this thing in psychology, whatever, like, you know, where's the hostility coming from, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was also just a way of keeping people from dealing, from rising up. You know, hey, don't get so hostile. So sometimes those strong opinions, you don't want there to be a world where there's no strong opinions. But so for me, it's all balance.
Right.
It's all like, because I was into that self-righteous, I'm changing the world with my comedy, that's not a good place to be in. But
right.
I don't think I'll ever not look at something and make a snarky comment about it.
And by the way, just to clarify, I'm not saying that there's never a need for armed resistance or overthrowing things or whatever. You know, there obviously it's a you know what
continuum.
I'm saying.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's a continuum. I'm just talking about people that all of a sudden their lives become a tornado of attacking and defending, and they're forgetting what the primary cause
that
is.
That was me.
You know, Martin Luther King never had to, denigrate anybody or belittle anybody, and he changed the world in incredible ways.
Right, and yet there are people who I can't stand online who are saying, I don't like that he was, the part of him that was religious was him assuming the habits of his of masters. You know what I mean? They won't even allow the spiritual side to him.
One of the things that comforts me when I start to get upset at the direction that the world is heading in, and I then get into a place of fear of, oh my God, I got to move to Canada. Nobody's ever going to love me in Canada, so I'll never become a full citizen. I wish I was kidding. I try to remember that everything in the universe has an opposing force. And to think that we should be any different is lunacy. I don't think you're ever going to get to a point where there isn't an opposing faction. So the question is, how do we live with people that disagree with us in a way that is principled, and we don't become somebody that we dislike?
Right.
How do you do that? How do you be a good citizen and also be a good person? And that's the struggle for me.
I think it's situational too, and it's like when these people online say you can't call Trump. Show me how Trump is a racist, right? And you go, well, he was a birther. And they'll say, well, that's not racism. It's like that when people
wasting your time. That person's already made their mind.
No, but I'm not even talking about that. I know about the thing where the actual belief that it's not racism, or belief that it's something else.
Right.
To me, is like not to be able to say the truth. Sometimes it's important to say the truth, and sometimes it's important to let it go. So, for example, if you're a white guy and you go, look, this Black Lives Matter thing, I mean, you know, we all have troubles, but calm down. You know, you're not relating to what it would be like. I have never been a black person driving around and getting stopped, right? So when white people go, look, there's no more racism, you know, that's just a whole school of nonsense, right?
Yeah, I think we all
agree. We're not arguing, are we? We're agreeing to agree to check it out another time. See, now, I just want to tell you that this I do on a certain level for this entire time without getting it to be Richard Lewis proportions because he's one of my heroes, but I do kind of hate myself all along the interview. I mean, in a low level. It's a low level. But it's a part of myself that says, you're dominating, you're not listening to the person, you're not doing this. So, and regardless of what the truth was, you could say, oh, I did feel that way, or I didn't feel that way. The answer is that addressing that core feeling, I used to not address that feeling and just spend my whole life trying to make everyone like me.
Yeah.
By hating them intensely.
Yes. Well, if you practice hating yourself enough, eventually you'll get good enough to hate other people. That's the message I give kids.
That's, I'm sure.
Practice. Practice, practice. Ladies and gentlemen, Andy Kindler.
Thank you.
I love you, man.
I love you, too.
I love you. Thank you guys so much for coming out and supporting the show and supporting L.A. Podfest.
I sure do love me some Andy Kindler. I want to tell you guys about RX Bar. RX Bar is a whole food protein bar made with a few simple, clean ingredients, which all serve a purpose. Egg whites for protein, dates to bind, nuts for texture. And in the interest of full transparency, all of the core ingredients are labeled right on the front of the package, no BS. They have 11 flavor varieties, all of which are gluten-free, soy-free, dairy-free, free of any added sugar, artificial color or flavors, preservatives or fillers. And you can actually taste the cacao, the fruit, the spices like sea salt. I love the chocolate sea salt one. I think that's my favorite flavor that they have, although the chocolate peanut butter is really good too. And the texture of their bars, silky is the best word. You have to try it. So whether you like sweet or savory, chocolate or fruit flavors, there's an RX bar for you. For 25 20% off your first order. Visit rxbar.com/mental and enter the promo code mental at checkout. That's rxbar.com/mental and then fill in the promo code mental for 25% off your first order. This is a body shame survey. We haven't done those in a while, and this was filled out by, why am I whistling all of a sudden? This is filled out by Warm Tape, and she writes to the question, what do you like or dislike about your body and why? She writes, I've had people close to me who couldn't walk or had difficulty walking without pain. I like that my legs function well and that I can walk without pain. I don't like all the scars on my arms. I used to be a cutter. They'll never go away. In my whole life, people are going to be making judgments based off of them. I have to wear long sleeves during job interviews, and I'm always afraid they'll fire me after they find out about the scars or my hiding them. Whenever I have to see a doctor or a nurse, they ask about my scars, even if it's totally irrelevant to the situation. I once went to get a pap and had the nurse ask me about my arms. My first thought was, unless I have scars on my vagina, how is this any of your business? Same thing happened when I went to see a doctor about a back spasm. These are scars, not cuts, no recent activity to concern a doctor. I've thought about saving up for laser surgery, but I don't want to erase my past. The scars are a reminder of how tough I am and how far I've come. I don't think self-harmers should have to hide. Agreed. Agreed. And, you know, it's funny when we're in that place where we're so afraid people are going to judge us, we forget that everybody has something that they're struggling with. And most everybody is walking around completely consumed with negative thoughts about themselves or, you know, grandiose thoughts about themselves. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by Depression as a Punchline. And they write, the semester after my friend died, I experienced crippling, soul-sucking depression, and I completely screwed up my academics. I'm a psych major, and at the time I was enrolled in a class on subjective well-being, or the scientific study of happiness. I literally failed happiness class. Thank you for that. This is Struggle in a Sentence. Balsamic vinegar. I enjoy you on my salad. Writes about her depression. I feel numb for days, then cry when I drop a grape. Oh, that is perfect. That is perfect. I remember breaking down and crying one time because I couldn't find a parking space. I was so angry. I was just beating my hand on the steering wheel, angry at this neighborhood because it's just overcrowded and just screaming that the people that live there are all lemmings. Oh, completely unaware that the fact that I was at that point an untreated alcoholic might have had something to do with my anger and sadness. Maureen fills out an awfulsome moment, and I'm just going to condense it a little bit, but she wasn't able to get her med refilled because she'd kind of spaced out and wasn't able to get to the pharmacy because of her work schedule. So she ran out of her SSRIs, and she was feeling the side effects of going through too fast of a withdrawal. So she was experiencing nausea, headaches, hot flashes. She writes, the next few days were an absolute nightmare, but I was able to get a friend to pick up my medication for me. So I was eventually back to my average level of daily dysfunction. I was, of course, miserable, but one thing I fondly look back on in retrospect was some of the absolutely ridiculous stuff that reduced me to tears, which I thought I'd share. One, my birthday. 2, my best friend's birthday. 3, a car commercial that used Sweet Caroline, which we sang at my alma mater. 4, my best friend's birthday again. 5, my nails were too long. 6, the litter box was dirty. 7, we only had yellow popsicles left and I wanted red ones. 8, Usain Bolt finished 3rd in his last race. 9, I felt guilty for calling my cat mean names. 10, I was crying so loudly about being mean to the cat that the cat was scared, which made me cry again. 11, I was so thankful that a friend had come to stay with me. This one involved getting snot all over that friend's sweater. And 12, my favorite shorts were in the laundry. Oh, my God. I love it, too, when you go from crying to seeing something ridiculous about it, and then you're laughing. Stanley writes about his depression. It feels like I'm running a marathon in slow motion, and I'm the only one who notices I'm falling behind. About his anxiety, it feels like I have 1,000 bees under my skin, all buzzing at once. Wow, that is so easy and horrible to picture. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by scared shitless and their gender fluid. And they write, I had terrible constipation as a kid. It lasted for years and no one ever figured out why. I would poop maybe twice a week and it would usually take me a half hour to an hour. I generally avoided pooping anywhere that wasn't my home bathroom because of this. On one awful day in first grade, I decided to attempt the impossible. I remember the teacher had everyone in my class line up to use the bathroom that was inside our classroom. One by one, kids went in, peed, and left. I remember standing in line feeling like I might have to risk it and poop before I got home. I debated whether or not it was worth taking a humiliating long time while half the class waited right outside. When it was my turn, I initially felt like it wouldn't take too long, so I started to go. But it wasn't working. I had felt like I would soil myself any minute if I didn't try, but this was like trying to pass a tennis ball. Eventually, the rest of the kids in line started to get upset and started knocking on the door. This did not help. It seemed like I would just have to call it quits and hope for the best. But then the door opened. To make a terrible situation even more awkwardly humiliating, my outfit was a one-piece thing that zipped up in the back. In order to go to the bathroom, I basically had to completely undress. So there I was, sitting naked and constipated on the toilet in front of the rest of my first grade class. Stunned, awkward silence. A few moments later, a teacher hurriedly closed the door and asked if I was okay. I started to get dressed right away, but my outfit was really hard to zip up on my own. It took me a while to move the zipper up at all, which caused even more agitation and concern. I ended up having to walk out defeated with my back still exposed to get the teacher to zip me back up. On top of failing to shit, I had also failed to dress myself. The whole thing was pretty mortifying at the time, but these days I look back and think it is hilarious. Oh my God. Oh, thank you for that. Thank you for that. Is there any reason to ever wear a one piece or a jumpsuit? Honestly. Maybe powder skiing so it doesn't get down into your pants. Jimbo writes about his generalized anxiety disorder. When someone asks you what triggers your anxiety, and you ask them if they have to be anywhere in the next 3 hours. In a snapshot from his life, he writes, someone asked me what makes my anxiety tolerable, and all I could think of was that feeling when you realize you're drunk. That sweet, sweet feeling. I don't miss it, actually. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by Bipolar Bear. And she writes, about a month into my new job, I was psychotic and depressed and wound up in the hospital. I was out of town for work the week prior to my hospitalization, but had promised friends that once I returned, I would go to the hospital and get assessed. By the time that week ended, I was falling apart. And if you've ever been hospitalized, you probably know that you tend to get worse the first few days there, because inpatient is a pretty depressing place. On my second day, two of my good friends came and visited me, and I think I probably looked like the life had been sucked out of me. But these friends knew something to bring that would cheer me up. 1/2 gallon of whole milk. I love milk, and it's always been something to laugh about. So these dear friends brought me some good milk rather than the horrible stuff in the cardboard cartons. Now, I was there for my bipolar disorder, but the hospital was convinced I was anorexic, too. It does run in my family. because I was refusing to eat. So the doctors were pleased I was consuming some calories, and luckily drinking a half gallon of whole milk is like 400 calories. So my friend who visited me also worked at the hospital and requested that they get whole milk served with all of my meals. After the visiting hour was over, the goodbyes were really hard and I still felt lifeless. And the next morning when I was refusing to get out of bed, there was one thing that motivated me to crawl out. There was a tall glass of whole milk waiting for me. Not only do I love milk, but it was also a reminder of my friends really caring for me. Every time she visited me, she brought me more milk and convinced the hospital to let me keep the extras after visiting ended, even though that's against the rules. The hospital was rough and visiting hours are always bittersweet, but my friend bringing me my milk and ensuring I had at least 300 calories a day from the milk alone actually did help me get better. Oh my God. It seems like that should be from the Milk Council. Some of the best awfulsome moments that you guys share are ones that come when people are hospitalized. Mindful Mess shares about being a sex crime victim. Like a faulty product that has become devoid of any use, but also can't be returned. That is a profound one. She also struggles with dermatillomania, and she writes, "Dermatillomania for me manifests itself in not only compulsively scratching and squeezing my face and shoulders in my quest for the holy spot, but also in scratching my scalp and chewing my lip and the inside of my cheeks. This looks particularly stupid, and I've noticed that I'm getting what looks like a chain smoker's wrinkle above my upper lip from this constant grimacing. I recently went on a day out with my family, and my sister took a lot of pictures, and on about 80% of them, I was pulling my typical side kiss chewing myself up face, and it's so embarrassing. My parents and friends who know will remind me to stop doing that or slap my hand away, but that does nothing but increase my shame and anxiety. What's worse, my younger sister has copied the whole lip-biting, cheek-chewing habit, and so I can add the feeling of being deeply sorry into the mixture. The only funny thing must be to see us both together when we're on the tram or the supermarket queue. Two girls eagerly chewing their own faces." Thank you for sharing that. Isn't it weird sometimes how just a passing stranger can be more aware of what's going on with us in a moment than we are? Somebody that we've never even met, somebody that doesn't even know our name, can sometimes see an issue that we may never even realize that we're battling. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by JG. And JG is gender fluid. And they write, "My therapist wanted to send me to group social anxiety workshop sessions, but she couldn't as they had been canceled due to low attendance." That's like a joke. Sally Boy, who is a trans male, writes about, gives us a snapshot from his life. He struggles with depression, OCD, a bunch of other stuff, but a snapshot from his life that highlights his life. "No, Mom, I am not overreacting when I'm uncomfortable with you texting while driving 80 in a 45 while you're drunk." Holy fuck. Melissa C. writes about her depression. Oh, this one is so good. "Depression feels like being alone forever." That is t-shirt worthy. And I'm sure that'd be a big seller. About PTSD, "I am being followed by everyone who hurt me." Wow, those are really good. Thank you for that, Melissa. That's sometimes what, you know, I think the reason that I started that struggle in a sentence survey is sometimes the gasoline on the fire is that you can't find the words to accurately express your anxiety or your depression, your compulsive behavior, or, you know, whatever it is that you're going through. This is a shame and secret survey filled out by a gender-fluid person who calls himself Suma. And they are pansexual, in their 30s, raised in a totally chaotic environment. They were the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. As a kid slash teen, I was sexually abused by my grandfather, uncle, and a boyfriend. I felt okay about it, like it gave me survival skills. I was proud of my resilience. I was productive, had multiple jobs, projects, lots of friends. Then 3 years ago, I was violently raped by a work client. That took all of my strength and will from me. Now I spend most days in bed, exhausted from insomnia and nightmares. I feel like there's no escape. I'm terrified those years in my early 20s were my one chance to live and be happy, and now it's gone. They've also been physically abused and emotionally abused. From the age of 5, my father would often tell me that I was a whore. It was my fault he was an alcoholic, and that one day he will kill me, my mother, and himself, and it would be my fault. My mom used to bundle us kids up into the car at night to sleep. She'd go park outside a 24-hour convenience store so there would at least be a witness if he found us and something happened. I always kept a knife on me in case I needed it. Any positive experiences with the people who abused you? My father was depressed and had an abusive childhood himself. He was struggling, and I wish he could have gotten the help he needed. Darkest thoughts. I don't know how awful the violence has to be before somebody will care or notice. So far, it hasn't been enough. Darkest secrets. When I was 5, I gave my brother, then 10, a blowjob, but I don't consider that time abuse. At the time, he was also being sexually abused by our neighbor, and I think we were both just fucked up kids. I forgive him. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. 1, I'm a child and being molested by an older man, but he soothes me and tells me it's going to be okay, and I'm not scared. 2, I'm fucked while I'm asleep and I don't wake up. I'm oblivious to it. 3, I give great head, he blows on my face, slaps me, and leaves. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone that you haven't been able to? My mom told me she got an abortion after me because she couldn't bring another child into a violent home. I want to ask her why it was good enough for me. Wow. This is one of the heavier surveys I've read in a while. What, if anything, do you wish for? Peace. I don't know what that feels like, but fuck, all I want is to know what peace feels like. Have you shared these things with others? I went to a psychiatrist and got so distraught I vomited into the bin in his office. He said that I'm weak and dramatic and really should be able to cope better. I never went back. That motherfucker should be run out of town. He should have his license revoked, and he should be fucking... I never advocate for shaming people, but I want to see that motherfucker shamed. And you, in your fucking moment of need, that guy wounds you again. How do you feel after writing these things down? It forced me to cry. I feel relieved. Is there anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? You are allowed to be a fuck up. Your grief, your perspective, your craziness is a knowledge I value. You have so much to offer, your trauma included. And I hope you hear that, because you're all of these horrible things that you've been through. There are other people who have experienced these, and they think that they're alone. And if you can ever connect with another survivor, I think it could be really healing for you. I don't know what would happen, but I think it's better than isolating. at least give it a shot because you're worth it. And there are good people in the world. Thank you so much for sharing all of that really, really painful stuff. And I just hope you can take your own advice and find the support that you deserve. This is a happy moment filled out by OCD Potato. And she writes, I've been going through some difficult stuff lately and it's left me feeling pretty alone. Just when things were on track and I'd made tremendous progress, my mental illness overwhelmed me once more to the point that a small thing became an atom bomb in my future. And yet this time I didn't fully succumb to my urges. I didn't let myself burn everything down. I took time to sit with the emotions and let them be there despite the immense pain. And I knew from the bottom of my soul that I'd survive it no matter what. I shopped, but only $10 worth. I had soda, but only one can. I went to my job and I did my best. I didn't lash out at people. I cut my hair, but only a trim. I cut myself off from people, but only for 3 or so hours. At the end of it, I had someone message me asking how I was. Considering the situation, I told them pretty shitty, and I carefully summarized the painful consequences of my situation. They responded with, well, at least it's over now. How's everything else? What? Over? I got so angry. When someone tells you that their parent died, do you respond with, well, at least they're dead, so you don't have to worry about their health anymore? I then vented to my best friend about how insincere and lacking empathy this person's response was. My best friend instantly jumped in with, yeah, it's so fucking dismissive. It's like you're venting. You're not looking for fix-its or to be given silver linings and platitudes. You're talking about real pain that you're going through. Exactly. That's why I was so angry. See? You don't give platitudes. You listen and validate. She laughed. Well, to be honest, you helped me to learn how to do that. What do you mean? I asked. You taught me not to be a dick under the guise of being nice, how to really listen to someone, not just offer platitudes, and I appreciate it. I'd forgotten about it. I forgot that I have an impact on people. She's not the first person that's told me I've helped them to be a better listener. In fact, this week, I had my last meeting with my caseworker of over a year, and she too told me that I've impacted the way she deals with her clients because I was always so open and honest about how different ways of responding affect the outcome of our conversations and helped her understand better. She's passed along countless ideas and resources that she's got from me, and she's appreciated how much I've taught her. I'm going to be okay, no matter the outcomes. Thank you for that. And finally, this is an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself Talks to Strangers. And she writes, after joining some of my friends for a drink, I made my way to the post office bus stop. My bus came and everyone crowded to get through the doors. I was one of the next to go on the bus when an officer pushed us away and told us to take the next one, since the one we were trying to get on was full. This led to a murmur of dissatisfaction among those of us who had to wait. In this disgruntlement, I found myself talking to a girl named Katie. As me and Katie were chatting about wanting to get home soon, she paused the conversation and made a disgusted face to someone behind me. What was that? I asked. Oh, him, she said. He raped me. Wow. That was heavy. However, it led to such a beautiful conversation. I, myself, am a victim of sexual assault. To hear another person so honestly proclaim that they have been sexually assaulted made me feel more understood and less alone. When our bus finally came, Katie and I continued the conversation. We talked about being victims of rape and having to explain that rape to others. We discussed how hard it is to validate to ourselves that we were victims of rape. Recently, I've been feeling a very strong presence of my anxiety and depression. Often, I find myself remembering incidents of sexual abuse when I'm going through this. Although the topic of me and Katie's conversation was very dark, I felt such a sense of joy when I got off at my bus stop. Talking to people is incredibly vital to growth and healing. Her honesty was beautiful, and it made me feel so good to know that a complete stranger felt so comfortable with opening up to me. Thank you. Thank you for that. And that's funny. I thought, I wasn't even thinking when I put that survey a couple behind the other one that I read. It's, is it serendipity? I want to once again tell you about the Heaven's Gate podcast launch. Check it out. It's where Glenn Washington explores the story behind the mysterious cult. You can find it in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And the last thing I want to say is, at my support group meeting tonight, somebody talked about the difference between wanting something and being willing to have something. And the difference, I'm sure I'm mangling it, but the difference between wanting something and being willing to make it happen is a difference between something that is passive and something that is active. And I don't know about you guys, but for me, sometimes to get up off my ass to do something, I have to be either scared or desperate. And desperation can be the biggest gift that you've ever had, because it can be a touchstone for change. If I hadn't known that I was going to kill myself 17 years ago or 14 years ago, both of those times, I like to, on the anniversary, I like to put myself into a depressed spiral and just revisit the fun. I wouldn't have gotten help. And I would have missed out on all of this. And I know I say this a lot when I close the podcast, but it's so important. It's so important, because what you are experiencing is not who you are. It is not who you are. It is not your value in the world. It may suck and it may be challenging as hell, but it might also be something that helps you develop an inner strength or communication tools or God knows what else that will make your life beautiful. Just a thought. So if you're out there and struggling, just never forget that you're not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautiful.
Everybody I know is
bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. Like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.